CliffCentral.com.
Good morning, everybody. Yeah, you made it to Wednesday. This is very successful. I mean, you know, we're taking the small victories. That's what we've got here. And this morning we have incredibly with us. I'm very pleased to welcome to the show. First time, I think. I mean, Alan, you've been on Cliff Central before. I think you've been on my show before, and you've been on Casper's show, and you've been all over the place. Alan Committee, look at him in all his glory. There he is. There you look. Huh? You look fantastic. You look great. What's been happening with you, man? How have you been doing through all of this ridiculousness of the last couple of years?
Yeah, and it certainly has been plenty of ridiculousness.
Yeah,
totally. It seems kind of evening out a little bit. Corporate stuff has picked up a little bit. A bit of MC and some funnies around.
Yeah.
And very thankfully, the theatres have opened up now finally to 100%. So that's
good.
Made a huge difference.
That's good.
Not only for the comedy shows, but for some of the stuff that I produce and acting, which is slightly more serious and kind of needs as many bums and seats as possible to make it viable.
So hell yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Simpiwe Mtetwa, it's good to see you, Simpiwe. How are you doing this morning?
I am good. How are you?
Excellent. For those who are always asking, Simpiwe is not available for dates this week. She has decided even more. We're going to make sure we don't break any rules here. We're going to make sure we know.
No, Gareth, don't do that. What if my potential husband is like watching and now you've just said don't try anything?
No, if he loves you enough, if he loves you enough, he won't listen to me. I mean, really. Come on. So Alan Committee, for anybody who doesn't know by now, is one of South Africa's leading award-winning comic performers. He's also performed in the UK and the US, and he's best known for his comic one-man shows, but is also renowned for his eight-year stint as the star of the Broadway hit Defending the Caveman. And, of course, he is also in a new show, which is happening. It's called Love Factually. It's at the Theatre Marcellus at Emperor's Palace. So when does that start? This week?
That's right. Yeah, just two nights this weekend.
Excellent.
A quick in and out. So, but lovely to do the show again. This was a follow up to Caveman. Essentially, what happened was Caveman was written by an American comic almost 32 years ago now.
Right.
And we between Tim Plumen and myself, there were over 2,000 performances in this country.
That's right.
But essentially, with rights and royalties and exchange rates, it just became a silly notion to continue doing it here. At one point, they were trying to charge us 50% of our takings. So we thought, well, stuff that, and we quietly told them to maybe reconsider that. They didn't. So between Peter Turin and myself, we decided we would write a kind of follow-up version. And so Love Factually was born about 4 or 5 years ago. And it's a kind of slightly more modern take on dating and a look at the foibles between, you know, couples and all the genders and et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, that show's been floating around now, and I kind of revisit it intermittently between other projects.
So Caveman has been probably performed more on South African stages than almost any other show, if you work out the number of total shows.
Sydney is a soda.
Yeah, I mean, that's incredible. And this is obviously a subject which really resonates with people. I mean, we often end up talking about relationships on this show, even though I'm not the world's expert by a long shot. I've pretty much ruined or screwed up or at least exited after only a very short time most of my relationships. I'm no expert at all. Simpiwe has also got a shit track record. I mean, everybody else on the show.
You're on a roll today,
everybody else on the show, you know, from Leanne on Mondays to Ben on Fridays. We haven't got terrific depth and success here. I mean, what kind of personal relationships have you had in your life that inform this? Because you have to have some experience to be able to talk about these things.
Sure, but they don't have to be good experiences, because any experience will inform, you know, some knowledge about it. It doesn't make you an expert. I don't think anyone's an expert at it. I suggest that people who've been married for 45, in fact, last Sunday in Cape Town, I did this at Corp Bay Theatre, we had a couple who had been married for 58 years.
Wow.
And who's to say that's successful? It's certainly long. I remember I'm a qualified high school teacher, and the guy who taught me English methodology all those years ago said, there are many teachers out there who have 25 to 30 years of experience, but it could be 30 years experience of the same bad year.
Right.
So don't assume longevity is, you know, brilliance. And I think the same of a relationship. There might be people who've done well to stay together. Are they happy? Well, I don't know. So I think part of the pleasure of both Caveman and perhaps even Love Factually is that I position myself as someone who's learning literally in front of the audience and really turns to the audience, you know, theoretically or maybe even figuratively and says, can you help me? Because this is what's puzzling me or this is what's befuddling me. And perhaps you can recognize some of this, which, of course, is what makes the show. And by the way, not just in this country. I think they've been at its peak in the late 90s, early 2000s. There were 16 productions of it around the world, including one in the Middle East, which I would have paid some good money to see how that show
Played out. They've got an interesting take on a lot of that stuff.
Yes, they certainly do. Exactly.
So Alan,
there's a Vegas version that's still running. It has been running now for 30 years. So it certainly has spoken to a universal kind of resonance around relationships.
I do want to spend a bit of time this morning talking about you and your incredible kind of career and the things that you've done and the people you've met and the places you've been. But I'd also, you know, we kind of just want to talk about all the stuff that's going on in the world today and kind of get your take on that. Before we get onto all of that stuff, though, how do you learn lines? I mean, this is always something that sounds so easy and simple and stupid to people who are in the profession, who've been acting, who've done comedy. Well, I mean, I can't learn a script of like 5 sentences.
Right.
And I've got all day to do it and it's 5 sentences. And yet you could get up on a stage for 2 nights and do a show. And obviously there's a little bit of improv here and there. But to remember where it's going, I would get lost. I have to write down everything I say or I just have to wing it. There's no in between. Like I can never learn this stuff. How do you actually sit down and learn this kind of material?
So I would answer that in two ways. The one is to say your skill, people will ask you, how do you wing it? How do you sit down for 2 or 3 hours with your show, whether it's on radio or live, and make it sound like you're very erudite and well-opinionated and intelligent? Well, I would suggest you do that because A, it's kind of in your DNA, but B, years and years of experience have given you the innate ability, like driving a car, like riding, it's in your body now, and you're able to do it quicker and more efficiently with perhaps even less preparation. I would say learning words becomes a muscle. It's certainly training your parts of your brain that allow you to remember stuff. And the more you learn stuff, the better you get at it, the quicker you're able to do it. That's the first thing. The second is, when I'm learning gags for shows, stuff that I've written, I find that very easy because I want to get the laugh. So I want to know the exact right word I have to say in the exact right order to get that laugh.
Right.
So there's an intention behind it. And if that sounds wanky and obvious, that's all it is. You if you want to, you will. Now, the other side of that is when I'm doing acting. And I can actually announce, this is a Gareth Cliff Central first, if you will. But we're about to announce tomorrow or Friday that we're going to do a production of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
Oh, wow.
In fact, it's a 60th anniversary production, the first production back in 62. And Sylvain Strike is directing, me and Robin Scott. Now, that script, which I'm learning at the moment, I'm on 117 pages of dialogue and most of that. So I am learning 5 pages a day at the moment. And when you say, how do you make it say, I don't know, because it doesn't feel easy right now. What I would say is that it will be easy. I like to learn theater lines in relation to having worked on the floor. In other words, if a director and an actor I'm working with, or 2 or 3 actors, we work together with script in hand, and I go home and I can learn the lines in relation to positions, to physical space, to intention. A director said on that line, you're upset and you actually feel frustrated. I can link that frustration to a line or two. Or go, oh, yes, this is where Robin's on my right. She's walking back to the bookcase. That's when I swing around and say that line. It's easier then to connect context to certain lines and remember it that way. To learn lines in a vacuum here at home, not having done it, man, I'm finding that tough.
Yeah, that's hard. I mean, that's the thing, you know, because obviously I would be so talented, I'd just be brilliant. I'd walk onto stage and be a terrific actor. That's the thing that's holding me back is like I can't learn the lines. If only you gave me the power to learn lines, I'd be fantastic. Finally, I'd get something right in my life. Oh my God. No, I couldn't do it. I mean, you've explained it very sensibly and it sounds right to me, but it's just not within my power.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's it. I guess we all have our own little superpowers. And
listen,
there are some actors who struggle. They don't have that skill, or they don't have it.
What do you do? What do you do if one of your co-stars in a show is forgetting their lines all the time and constantly letting everyone down, and you're having to retake, and it's pissing everyone off? How much patience are you meant to have, and how much are you allowed to lose your temper?
Well, that's a very good question. I think on a film and a TV set, what's great is it's frustrating, but there are solutions where you can literally start editing from line to line. So you just let them do one line, cut away to something, do one line. It makes for terrible visual pleasure, but you can get away with it. On stage, you then rely on fellow actors to pick up the energy, pick up the pace, pick up the story. I've been with an actor who would skip 3 or 4 pages of vital plot information.
And then Wait, what do you mean skip? Like in the middle of the sentence, they're already on page 10. You're like, no, that's not where we at.
Was this person drunk? Was this person drunk?
In fact, in this instance, he was a little drunk, to be fair. So the question is how much string can you give them? Well, maybe once, twice, but there are moments. Listen, I often end up being a producer on these shows, so you get a kind of added pressure on how then do you deal with them, not just as an acting colleague, but, as part of management, if you will. But, it's far less. It doesn't happen as often as you'd think, and most guys are, especially in this country, the work is rare. The stage work is so rare that to get into a production, and if you cast it well, I guess that's part of the secret anyway. You're not going to have that.
Corona's Boring says, practice makes perfect. That's why the politicians start lying from day one.
Yeah. They have no idea what their lines are. So they're making it up every moment.
All right. Well, that's stuff that I always am slightly jealous of. I'm jealous of that. I'm jealous of the ability some people have to write music. I find that to be a really, really enviable talent. But I see all this music in the background in your, where are we, in your office?
Yeah.
Are those DVDs?
Yeah.
No, these are DVDs. I'm an 80s and 90s baby. So these were DVDs that when we couldn't get stuff, remember in the 90s when when you traveled overseas, all I would bring back as contraband would be bags and bags of comedy and British television or American television that I couldn't access here. And I quite like having the physical thing, so I can't get rid of it. So I've got something like 3,000 or 4,000 DVDs here. And then behind me over here, these are I'm also a cricket man. So these are all my cricket DVDs and autobiographies. I do a podcast with Dan Nicol called Two Full Tosses, where we get an opportunity to talk a lot of crap with some great cricketers, international and local.
I saw Dan Nicol on Friday last week. He has a broken foot or something.
That's right, he does.
What did he do? He told me that, and I thought it was so embarrassing, I forgot.
Yeah, he tore his Achilles. It turns out his Achilles heel is his Achilles heel. who knew? And he hardly mentions it more than 6 or 7 times a second. So,
yeah, he's a real victim, hey? He loves a little bit of sympathy. What a pain in the ass. He couldn't stop. Look at my foot and look at my crutch and woe is me. And, can't you order me an Uber? And, can't you pay for my meal?
This was before the injury. It's been worse since he's got the injury.
I mean, really, if you're going to be a TV celebrity, you must have a little bit of pride and self-respect and not tell everybody about your weaknesses straight away. I mean, really.
That's right. Look at Leon Kravar. That's a stoic man.
I love that. All right. So Alan Committee's with us. Simpiwem Tetwa, me, you, everybody else, the comments section alive and well this morning. I see some people are already getting things done and doing some really cool stuff. Bailey is already at a very busy OR Tambo, about to go to East London. Well, I'm pleased our Tambo's busy because we only have like 1 or 2 airlines actually functioning at the moment, don't we? There are two.
No fun to be traveling across the country at the moment. If you don't book, 3 days ahead, your flights, everything's sold out on 2 days ahead.
That's right. I mean, it used to be that it just got more expensive, but you'd always be able to get a seat. Now, if you don't book well in advance, you won't even get a plane. So forget about it. You have to plan these things well in advance. It's terrifying. So, all right, have you done a lot of traveling over the last little while?
I have, and it's got kind of interesting and weird. Listen, I was traveling at one point just after hard lockdown finished when the airports were eerily quiet. I don't know if you did that. where you'd be like three or four people in the airport. That was kind of weird.
Alan, I flew back from a wedding in Durban at the beginning of lockdown. That was March of 2020. And it was the day before Cyril shut us down. Ooh. So
right.
I think people had already suspected something was going on. And I landed back at Lanseria, and I think there were like five people in the airport who were passengers. Right. You know, like there was the staff, and there was five maybe passengers. And that plane coming back was empty. And we were all walking around, like, you know, when I expected if we ever had a zombie apocalypse or something, this would be how it would feel. It was like this quiet, and people all looking at each other suspiciously, like, what's going to happen next? You know, can I trust you? What's going to go down here? I need to get home fairly quickly. Don't fuck around, you know, get on with it. That kind of thing.
Now, listen, this opens up an interesting question, which I play with friends sometimes. In a zombie apocalypse,
I love this game.
Which mall would you go to give you the best chance to escape the impending zombie kind of? Because in Cape Town, of course, there are many.
Which you've got, mall? Example, oh, the worst. Yes, no, the worst place you want to be is a shopping mall. There'll be so many people turning into zombies.
In this game, you have to go to a mall. You're not right. Near the same. Okay, make up your own rules. Simpiwe, I'm telling you what.
Okay, Simpiwe, you go first because you go to a mall where there aren't any people, like a shit mall. That's where you go. In my opinion. Where would you go?
I don't know, because you also want to be able to kind of like hide. And that's the thing. Like, I want to go to a mall that I know really, really well. So because I'm an East Rand girl, you know, let's stick with the East Rand. I will, because I know that mall like inside out, and it's only one, it's one floor. Yes. So I'd go with East Rand Mall. I think that's where I'd go.
I would go Four Ways Mall because no one can gain access to that mall at the moment.
Oh,
there's many roads around it, but there's no way to get in. So I'm assuming the zombies will have the same problem. Once you're inside, you can't find what you're looking for. So again, I'm assuming they will have that same difficulty trying to find me.
Well, as my friend Gord Laws always says when he's in characters, Hard Eddie, he goes, four ways in, no way out. So maybe that's a good one. You are right. It is surrounded by roads. Maybe that would, you know, it could be a good one only because it's got so many entrances and it's so goddamn confusing. And it's huge is the Mall of Africa. It's just so big.
Oh, no.
And if you, I mean, you could obviously be eaten by any number of a million zombies in there, but you could also escape via 20 different entrances, 900 parking areas.
And then you stay in the parking lot, you'll be fine.
Yeah, not even a zombie with a sense of smell could find you in that place because it's so confusing. So
and
maybe
you
that's.
Also have this, I mean, I grew up in Funderbell. Listen, I don't want to upset everybody here, but I grew up in Funderbell Park all those many years ago, and then I've mostly been a
I'm
Cape
sorry,
Town
we've lost. We've lost Alan. I'm so sorry. I don't know what happened. There.
Curse of the Vault Triangle strikes again.
Jesus.
But I want to say that there are certain places in each of the big cities in this country where there's certain suburbs I can't find. So in Cape Town, it's Heathfield. People tell me Heathfield.
Where the hell is Heathfield?
You're going towards Retreat, and then there's a sign that says Heathfield.
I don't even know where. Hold on. I don't even know where Retreat is. In Cape Town.
Where are you?
Heathfield.
No, so right now.
I think someone's taking the piss. Someone said to you a while ago, Alan, meet me in Heathfield just to mess with you so that you would drive around for hours and hours.
Awesome. But Mall of Africa is one of those for me because people often say, well, and I have a vague idea where it is, but it feels like it's in some kind of Twilight Zone-y. There are many ways to get there, but if you're not concentrating, you're past it before you arrive at it. Jeez.
Wow.
Before you lap yourself to get there again on another day.
Well, another Alan says, is anyone connected via Addis Ababa's airport? Is it any good? And then Snaya replied and said, I've been there before. It was the worst airport I'd connected from, but this was 2015. Things may have changed. It was apparently hot. The airport was being built. There were vendors in the airport, so it didn't feel like it was an international airport. There was no Wi-Fi. I couldn't get a SIM card anywhere. It sounds like hell. That's Addis Ababa. And you would obviously, if you fly Ethiopian Airlines, you'd have to fly with them. Vyasin says that's he'd go to Boulders in Midrand. Oh, no.
Doing Midrand.
I'll tell you what, Midrand may have the most vicious zombies of all, so I don't know if I'd want to be there. Dogoza says, yeah. I'm going to Bolito Junction. That place was a fort during the riots last year. Okay.
Ah, nice.
Clever. That's a good one.
Very.
Ethan says, I've gotten lost at every mall I've visited in Joburg, so malls are not a good idea for me. Tumi says, Rosebank Mall. At least you'll have quick access to the Gautrain tunnels. Clever. Except that those Gautrain tunnels will also be creeping with zombies.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Oh, Michael says this is a childish discussion and he's going. He's not staying.
Oh, bless him.
Well, let's give him a minute to leave.
What else was he expecting on Wednesday at 6:30?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, what you want us to be dissecting Prince Harry's fucking UN speech, really? You couldn't be. How can
it's
you?
Same,
not,
it covers the same area.
How can you not know Heathfield, Adam? It's the place between rich whites and then the coloureds. I actually stay next to it. So Yonder, are you?
Oh.
Are you on the border, literally, of being rich and white or being poor and coloured? Yes. You know, thank you, apartheid government. There's another great distinction, thanks to all those brilliant men so many years ago who decided to separate us by race. So now we have suburbs like Heathfield that nobody knows, except the people who live in Heathfield. Okay. All right. Very, very good. Here's someone who's also from Funabel Park. No need to go to the Mall of Africa. Don't need that stress in my life, says Clint. Yeah, but you're in Funabel Park. You don't have any money anyway. What would you do in the Mall of Africa? All right, lots of things to get to this morning. We want to hear from you. Send us your comments live on the YouTubes. You must also, as I always have to say, like and subscribe. By the way, Lebang, speaking of liking and subscribing, Lebang yesterday did send me a recipe to try out on the air fryer, and I know this is everybody's least favorite subject, but she did. I also saw her on social media yesterday with all of her children. There, she had four of them on a video with her. And they're all young and they were all like really sleepy. And I sent her a message and said, I don't know how you manage like four children.
No, Gareth.
Superhero.
There's a video that she posted before that. And she's like 2 weeks after giving birth, her body is snatched. She is looking all sorts sexy. I was like, girl, wait, what?
Right?
Like, this is you 2 weeks after popping out another kid. Okay. Mm-hmm. I might want to sign this deal, but she's looking absolutely amazing.
She is, and she's literally the best. She's a factory for producing children, and she's so good at it that she just goes snap back into shape and back into work. She's incredible.
Does she have them so that she's got more people to help in the kitchen? Is this part of her?
At this stage, they're too much work because they're still all young. There's one who's 8, and the rest who are like very, very young. So, you know, and there's a newborn now as well. So they're not helpful in the kitchen yet.
No, they don't become helpful till they're teens, do they?
Really? When can you put children into, like, hard work at home? 5?
Oh, the minute they can talk.
Really?
Talk and walk.
You think so?
Oh, yes. Like, if you can say, please, thank you, you can do some work. You can pick up that, you know, shoe that you left. You can pick up that toy. You start off very small. That's the trick. You don't get them to do hard stuff.
But
the minute they can, you know, they're conscious of like, oh, no, pick up that.
See, I
put
think
it
that's
there,
that's good.
Move that there.
What else?
And then you start with the cooking. You can help me chop.
You have to feed these children. You have to feed these children. You have to clothe them. You have to send them to school. You have to pay for all of their stuff. The least they can do is work like a team around your house.
100%.
Yeah. I don't believe any of this this nonsense of like, oh, no, you know, the children must be looked after and catered to for their entire childhoods. Not a chance. We were given not jobs to do.
Do you not have food in this house? Who bought that food? Yeah. It is me. So you are catered for. Like, are the lights not paid? You are catered for. Do you not have a roof over your head? You are catered for. The least you can do. The least. It's just wash the dishes. Come on now. That's the least
great.
You can do.
Yeah. Oh, this is amazing. Yonder says, I was in Mall of Africa last month. Not really that big to me, and there was parking available. It reminded me of Canal Walk here in Cape Town. There's always parking because there's so much of it. I don't think you could ever fill that parking. You'd need to take everyone off the highway, and then you'd still have enough parking.
I quite like that. I'd love to take everyone off the highway.
Oh, wouldn't that be nice? Wouldn't that be nice? Yeah. All right, well, we've got lots to get to in terms of the news. We've got some headlines. Let me get to those quickly and see what we can learn. about today. So first of all, Uber has got to pay $2.2 million to disabled riders over wait fees. So apparently, I don't know if this is something that's happened in South Africa yet, but in the US, the firm agreed to waive charges for disabled users in the future because there was a claim that was brought by the US government that its wait time fees discriminated against customers with disabilities because they take longer to get in the car because of the wheelchairs or whatever else it is. I would not, if I were an Uber driver, I wouldn't wait for the person in the wheelchair. It takes too long. Then it takes too long on the other side. You're losing money, man.
You have no sense of patience, Garrett.
None.
Like,
zero.
I mean,
zero. I would just say, I'd say, you see, this is why Uber would never hire me. I'd say, unfortunately, yeah. no cripples.
Yeah.
Because it's too...
No, well, let's not say cripples. I think that's good. Listen, the way our Uber drivers are going, this country, they don't pick up anyone anywhere. I haven't met an Uber driver now who picks up people. They're just there on the app, I think, as a kind of Tinder replacement.
Oh, nonsense. I am a fan. I will stand up for Uber. I've used them a lot. I don't have any issues with Uber. And look, I'm not a woman who's had an Uber driver make an unsavory comment or make a move. Obviously, that happens from time to time. It's going to happen anywhere in the world. There's going to be some creep in every job, right? They're creepy people in every profession. But I think that Uber is doing a terrific service. I just don't know that they should be handing out all this money to, in this case, the U.S. government. Who say that they're going to pass it on to disabled. Of course they won't. Governments never pass on the money. They always keep it. So apparently what they do is Uber charges a wait time fee in some cities, and they've been doing this since 2016. They've ended the practice now. The average fee was 60 cents. Under the terms of the deal, Uber agreed to pay more than $1.7 million to about 1,000 riders who had complained. So, I mean, sometimes complaining can earn you some money. I mean, you know, if 1,000 people, $1.7 million, that's a couple of $1,000s each. That's not so bad.
That's okay.
They paid some $500,000 more to some people who were identified by the Department of Justice. Officials said the statement would also yield hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars in compensation for more than 65,000 people who signed up to the waivers. Now, I don't know. Those people sound like they're taking a chance. People with disabilities, is what they said, should not be made to feel like second-class citizens or punished because of their disability, which is exactly what Uber's wait time fee policy did. So, there we go. Well, don't ask me for a lift if you're in a wheelchair because I don't have the patience and I won't wait. I'd rather get one of these Ubers. And if they're late, complain. And if you take a long time, complain again if they charge you.
If they want to make extra money in America, they should make that wait time about weight, about kilogram.
I agree, right? I agree with that.
That would
because as Corona's Boring says, with a 600 pounder, you'll need to use a lot of grease to get them in and out of the car or use a cake on a stick. That's a very good point. So we got to look out for that. It's very important information, this. Queen's Greatest Hits have sold 7 million copies, breaking a UK chart record. Now, yesterday we talked a little bit about music that is making a comeback from the 80s because of Stranger Things. Well, apparently their first Greatest Hits collection, that's Queen, the band, Freddie Mercury and Company from 1981, is now owned by one in every four households in the UK. So one quarter of all the households in the UK have a Queen album, which has meant that it is a perennial bestseller of all time. Recently spent its 1,000th week on the UK album chart. Queen guitarist Brian May called the latest achievement joyous news. No album has done this before in history, he said in a statement. Thank you, we appreciate it. Thank you very, very much. We're honored and humbled, and we salute you. Now, what's amazing about this, and Lebung came onto the show yesterday. Alan, if you haven't listened to the show before, Lebung is one of our regulars. And she said to me she woke up yesterday morning with Bohemian Rhapsody in her head. I don't know. And it is the song that has repeatedly and consistently won a greatest song of all time contest on every radio station anywhere in the world at any time. Because it just seems to appeal to everybody. And it really is like a breakaway, incredible, varied, genius work of musical art. Yeah. But, you know, I mean, that this is still making the money now? I have to ask this question, which I asked on Instagram yesterday. Have all the great songs already been written?
Ooh.
Yes. Yes.
You think so, Simpiwe?
Yes. Yes, there's only so many notes and so many keys and so many, like, the greatest song has been written. And I see it with, like, my generation, when it comes to music, that most artists are just sampling.
Yeah.
Like, their greatest hit is from a sample. So it's tickets, it's done. Like, you know, and we don't really have real talent now. So
we just have people just... A lot of the music that you like today, you go, oh, I like it because it sounds like, or it reminds me of, and then you go to something little from your generation, perhaps. Interesting that Bohemian Rhapsody came into a kind of consciousness, because, like Kate Bush's stuff in Stranger Things, because of Mike Myers, because of, what was the movie with Mike Myers? And remember they were headbanging in the car?
Was it Dumb and Dumber? No, it was... Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventures.
And so it did the same thing. It kind of came back in and people went, oh, look at this. This is amazing. But for many people before, they went, well, of course, Queen's been around forever. I own all of Queen's greatest hits. It sits here on a little shelf behind this computer. Big fan, yeah. I had a pleasure a couple of years ago. I did a pantomime in London.
Yeah.
I was doing work in the UK. And I worked with Brian May's wife, who's very famously a East Enders actress of many years, kind of like our Charlize Surtee Richards, well-known but very much a soap actress. And she was in the production, which meant Brian May came to watch the show two or three times. And I actually put in a gag for the show, knowing that he would be there, and I'm such a huge fan, who wouldn't be, where we had two guards. I was playing the kind of comic in the show, Chester the Jester. And I said to the director, can we call one of the guards who were unnamed, they were part of the company chorus, can I call one of them Brian? Because one of the lines she says at the end of the show is the evil witch, is she says to the princess, I would love to live a happy life like you. I'm so sad that I'm always kind of seen as evil and despicable. And they said, well, why don't you find someone lovely to marry? And she said, who would marry me? And I said, I'm sure
Brian May.
No, but Brian May.
Oh my God, that I'm dumb, dumb, dumb.
The crowd would go.
I mean, was he front and center? Could you see him? Because often when you're on the stage.
Oh, he came to me afterwards. He said, I love that gag.
Okay.
And I said, I mean, come on.
I love it. Oh, it was Wayne's World. I was thinking Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. It was Wayne's World. Yeah. Thank quite you, right. Yeah. See, we need people to correct us from time to time. Bohemian Rhapsody, that is. All right, so listen to this, just to follow up on that. According to the accounts filed by the band's company, Queen Productions, sales and streams of their music generated £39 million in royalties in just the last year.
Whoa.
Now, I mean, as much as we love Brian and Roger and whoever else is left, the fact is this is Freddie's money and he's dead, so they're all... Profiting handsomely off him not being around anymore, because really it's mostly his money that, you know, no one's coming to see Adam Lambert, you know.
No.
Let's be fair. No. Anyway, Elton John has warned the constant presence of greatest hits compilations on the album charts is starving newer acts of opportunities. He said the album chart is full of things like Me, ABBA, and Queen. He says the odd thing comes through like Sam Fender or Harry Styles, or you get a new artist coming in at number three and then disappearing. But he says it's depressing. This is Elton John. He's complaining about his success. He says, it's depressing.
You must stop talking.
There are a lot of good albums that deserve to be in the albums chart. And then he mentions here are a bunch of people I've never heard of in my fucking life. So let me go through. Jonita Ekka, Sharon Von Etten, and Angel Olsen. Oh. So, I mean, here's either Elton's trying to sound cool and in touch with music, which we know he is. I mean, he's done collaborations with everybody. You know, he's not afraid to do remixes of his songs. He's definitely one of the most tuned in and in touch people. So I don't think he's trying, but he does know what's going on in music. But don't try and throw us the stuff if we're not buying it, Elton. What I want to know, he says, is why aren't they there? Because of people like me. So here's the list at the moment. The best-selling albums of all time in the UK, all right? Number 10 is Queen's Greatest Hits 2. Number 9 is Michael Jackson's Bad. Number 8 is Dire Straits' Brothers in Arms. 7 is Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon. 6 is Michael Jackson's Thriller. That gives him 2 in the top 10. Oasis, What's a Story, Morning Glory at number 5. Adele comes in at 21 with, at number 4 with 21. The Beatles Only at number three with Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Heart Club Band, and then number two is ABBA's Gold. Number one is Queen's Greatest Hits. So how's that? What does that tell you?
Yeah. Make good music. Good music is timeless. We must not be like, we must see fresh blood and new blood. Mm. Hey, hey, ha, ha. No, artists need to make good music. Adele's on that list, and she's, right, you know, a 21st century artist. So, like, artists just really need to put in the work, and they'll get appreciated for it. Point blank, period. If we like those songs, we'll like them for eternity.
You'll assume that in your top 10 list, you're going to have classics, i.e., artists who've been around for a long time. And so the fact that, as you say, one of the 10% of that list is a new artist or relatively new artist, I think that's quite impressive. I'm not sure this argument holds water. I think let's look in 30-40 years' time. That top 10 list might have three or four more, maybe even two or three more, slightly more modern people, and that would make sense as well. You're not. It's very unlikely you're going to have four artists from the last 25 years in a top 10 list of all-time greatest owned albums. Yeah, no, I'm not sure this is a thing.
I like it. All right, so we've got to talk a little bit about something that is important to all of us, being healthy, feeling healthy, eating healthy, doing things that are healthy. We want to live as long as possible, and we want to live in the best possible condition because, man, I've seen a lot of my people that I love and respect let themselves go during lockdown. And I also think people are so unsure of what they should and shouldn't do and what they should and shouldn't eat. And frankly, I am always happy to hear from anybody who's got a little bit of good advice for us. So we've got Vanessa Asenshaw, who's going to join us in a moment. She's a dynamic, inspiring, and highly qualified nutritional consultant. She's also a health and wellness expert. She spent 15 years studying, researching, and working with some of the greatest minds in metaphysics, nutrition, and health. And she's helped celebrities, she's helped business executives, and other people transform their lives through a unique mind-body approach to health and nutrition. And she's here to give us some immune-boosting tips, which is terrific, especially at this time of year. There are still, on my clock, a month and a half of winter proper that we have to get through. And if you haven't got sick yet, well done. I was, I got my kind of month, what do you call it, annual cold and flu bout somewhere in May, and then it seems to have abated for some time, but you can never be too sure. So Vanessa, it's great to have you on the show. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me.
What a pleasure. It's nice to see you on the show. And as I was saying, this is something that we're all thinking about all of the time. So tell us a little bit about you before we get into some nutritional and health information.
So I've been in the health industry for about 25 years, and I studied in New York. So I did my Masters of Nutrition in New York, and I studied with Patrick Holford at the School of Integrated Nutrition. Mm-hmm. And my mom had a ovarian tumor, which was considered inoperable. And she decided to go to a lady in Johannesburg, Dr. Theo Avramides, who put her on a whole protocol of basically just changing her nutrition, working on her emotional state, which is very, very powerful, contributor to your well-being. A lot of us don't recognize the power of just, you know, holding resentment, anger, all those kinds of things, how they contribute metaphysically to your health.
Definitely.
Yes, 100%. And then, so she, after a year of treatment with this doctor, she went to her oncologist and they said it was spontaneous remission. There was no tumor. They couldn't believe it. So she started on the journey in the health industry. She was one of the first women in South Africa to own a healthcare company called BioHarmony at the time. So I grew up with a lot of awareness. I mean, my lunchboxes were, you know, not at all the usual.
Sweets and chocolates and things
at home. So I grew up in this industry and I've seen the most transformative with chronic illnesses, changes and transformations when you apply yourself to the basics, which is your nutrition, how you sleep, you know, your relationships around you, your purpose in your life. Those things are transformative. So I'm a big believer still in looking at the body in a holistic way. And there is always a time and space for pharmaceutical intervention, but right. It cannot only be that.
So how can we refine our nutrition and our lifestyles to boost something like immunity? I mean, what can we do about that? Because everybody coming out of COVID, obviously, we were very aware of this. But colds and flu are something that we can avoid. And people talk about having a strong immune system. How do you boost that?
Okay, so it starts with the foundation. You know, nutrition is your foundation. So if you look at the things that deplete your immune system, it's inadequate sleep, high refined sugar, carbohydrates. Mm-hmm. If you have a blood sugar imbalance throughout the day, that weakens your immune system. If you're consuming a lot of sugar, it weakens your immune system by 70%. What we've learned from COVID, which is very interesting, is that the people that got very badly affected were those with metabolic issues. So, for example, if you had insulin resistance, pre-diabetes, diabetes, that seemed to cause a lot of issues, what we call cytokine storms, which is based essentially where the immune system attacks itself and it goes into overdrive, causes death, organ damage, and obviously respiratory issues. So if you look at the foundation of nutrition, just eat as close to nature as possible. Very, very simple. Most of us are too sedentary to be eating a lot of sugars and carbohydrates and all of that. So predominantly 80% vegetables is my belief, 20% protein, and the rest you add a little bit of fat. If we could possibly even try and eat two meals a day versus 6 or 8 or 12, what many people eat the whole day from the time they wake up to the time they go to sleep.
Right.
This will make a huge difference. So I'm a big fan of intermittent fasting. I see the immune benefits of it. I see that it controls your mood, your hormone, all of that. Very powerful. After nutrition, we go into supplementation. When we say boost our immune system, what we're essentially saying is that we want to support the immune system with key nutrients, like, for example, a lot of us take zinc and vitamin C. 100% are essential nutrients that help modulate the immune system. Mm-hmm. I do believe in extracts like spirulina. I'm a big, big believer in spirulina. Spirulina's got over 1,800 peer-reviewed scientific studies showing its benefits for the immune system, for energy, to reduce inflammation. Now, at the root cause of just about every illness is inflammation. So we want to systematically reduce inflammation, so helps control blood sugar levels, very, very good for athletic performance. So this is like the most nutrient-dense food in the world.
So I just want to stop you quickly because a lot of people don't know what spirulina is. I remember there was a stage in the 90s where it was all the rage. All anyone was talking about was spirulina. They were saying that if you don't have this in your diet, you are bound to be less healthy. Yeah. This is a magic substance. Just tell us what it is, because I don't think a lot of people even know what spirulina is necessarily. Mm-hmm.
Sure. So spirulina is the oldest life force in the world, the oldest food in the world. It's been in Iran for over 3.5 billion years. Mm. And what puts spirulina on the map? And it's grown in water and, in lakes, everything. So what put spirulina on the map was NASA used to give spirulina to its astronauts in space missions. And they did successfully. So because it's so nutrient dense, you are able to survive on it. So what most of us lack is we lack nutrients. We consume a lot of calories, but we're not consuming nutrients. So when we supplement, we need to be very strategic with regards to making sure that we're getting the nutrients that our biochemistry needs. Most of us are completely deficient nutrients. We can be very overweight, probably obese, and we have high body fat with no nutrients. So I always try and assist people, like, instead of focusing on macros and calories, try and eat in a way that gives you nutrients. So the body functions with nutrients specifically. Calories is just a form of energy. So you create energy the more you eat, and you lose energy the less you eat. What we want to focus on is nutrition. So NASA gave the astronauts spirulina as a form of nutrition that they could survive on. Just to give you an idea, Gareth, spirulina, for 3 grams of spirulina, which is essentially 1 teaspoon, has more antioxidant and anti-inflammatory properties than 5 to 6 servings of vegetables. So for those of us who are completely, you know, eating badly, you know, not getting enough nutrients, spirulina is like, you know, body armor.
It's incredible. I think, you know, a lot of us are trying to find, I mean, Alan and Simpiwe, you can join in here too, because we're all trying to find out what that balance is. And obviously, if you can take the right supplements, which I think is primary here, you know, in the mornings you mentioned vitamin C, you mentioned zinc. I mean, I try to just take a very simple regimen of things just to make sure that the body's got all the stuff that it needs. Because if those ingredients aren't in the food that you're eating, you are in a lot of trouble. Obviously, if you're eating the right food, you don't need to take so many supplements. But who does? Because these days we don't know what's in the food and nobody actually reads the packaging. Do you? Alan, Simpiwe, do you read the packaging? No.
You're talking about a man who has an awful diet. So this is interesting. It really is interesting. And also, when you're performing or you're up early as you are or up late as I am, and you're eating, intermittent fasting happens out of necessity. I just don't have time, or then load all the food in 2 hours between 3 and 5 in the morning.
Oy.
When I finally get to sleep. It's no good. It's no good to nobody.
That is terrible.
I'm taking spirulina now. I'm going to just grab a bucket of it and bath in it.
So hang on. What form does the spirulina take, Vanessa? Is it tablets? Is it a powder? What tablets. Do we do?
Yeah, so Marcus Rohrer's spirulina is the one I personally take and I recommend to my clients because, Gareth, you want to be careful where the spirulina is grown and where it comes from. So Hawaiian spirulina is considered to grow in biosecure zones, which means that there's no heavy metals, no toxicity, no PCBs, mercury, etc. You know, you get spirulina growing in dodge places in China. And I think any supplement that anybody takes, you should get the certificate of analysis to ensure, especially if you're taking things like fish oil, spirulina, that you are insured that it comes from a region that is safe and free of PCBs, mercury, etc. So spirulina, because it's an algae, it absorbs its environment. So you want to ensure that whatever it's like, you know, if you're eating animal protein, you eat what the animal eats. It's the same with algae. So if spirulina is absorbing high contamination in its environment, you will then consume this. So Marcus Rohrer spirulina is essentially Hawaiian spirulina. And it's in a biosecure zone. And it comes in little tablets. They're really, really small. So what's interesting is spirulina is actually alive. And it comes in this beautiful blue bottle. It's a Viasol glass. It's a technology that's been developed. That if you, for example, take fresh lavender or a fresh herb and you put it into this Viasol glass, it will stay fresh. So this, where the spirulina comes, you must never buy spirulina in plastic, because it oxidizes the spirulina, and the spirulina then absorbs whatever's in the plastic, right? So you want to ensure that it's in a Viasol glass, which is the Hawaiian spirulina in a blue Viasol glass. And this keeps the freshness and the integrity of the spirulina because it oxidizes very, very quickly. And it's a beautiful green color. I usually take about 10 in the morning. They're super, super small. Some people take 30. I'm happy with the 10. And when you start off, with say 5 or 6, but they're super, super small. And this helps your body because you can go through a detox because it removes all the heavy metals out of the body. Mm-hmm. So some people feel a little bit nauseous or they get headaches or they have some kind of detox reaction. And this is a good sign because it's absorbing heavy metals. It also assists with liver function, all of that. So it's good to start off with 5 or 6 and never use, as I said, it's essential never to use spirulina that comes in plastic because it absorbs its environment.
Wow, that's amazing stuff to know. I didn't realize that, like, the packaging and everything else is important here too. All right, because we've only got a little bit of time left, and I really wanted to get some good advice from you here quickly. How can you stop an unhealthy habit like eating too much sugar, which we're all guilty of at some point, right? I mean, how do you stop that and make a permanent change?
Okay, so each one of us, if I give you, for example, 5 steps to do something, what stops us from doing it? And it's not, I can't tell you anything you don't already know, right? Mm-hmm. So I can tell the general public, stop eating sugar. The reason why we don't is it's because of the mind. So it's a habit. And what we have to do is we have to want to invest in our health a lot. So most people will change only when they get sick, right? So no one does preventative medicine or looking, you know, how am I going to eat for longevity? Very few of us do that. So until you get a diagnosis, you often don't change. So you have to want it and you have to mentally apply the principles of doing whatever it is you want to do, whether it's, you know, stopping drinking alcohol, stopping smoking, whatever it is. So you have to make the decision. And I believe in the cold turkey method. So the, in my clients, the most successful people are the ones that they make the decision mentally and they, within 3 or 4 days, Gareth, you can get off sugar and have absolutely no symptoms. The rest is just habit. So it's almost, you almost need like psychiatry interventions if you are unable to do it yourself, if that makes sense. It's, it's a very delicate situation. But in terms of physiology, 3 to 4 days, you can stop sugar if you just apply it. And what you do is you balance your blood sugar levels. So you take berberine. This helps control your blood sugar levels. You eat enough fats and animal protein at each meal. This controls your blood sugar levels. Protein is the most satiating nutrient. So you want to ensure adequate protein so that you don't crave. A lot of us are eating snacks, and this is what makes our body crave a lot of sugar. So berberine, and which is a natural supplement, and then adequate nutrition. So eat 2 to 3 meals, no snacks, protein, vegetables, and fat, and you're golden. Just have to do it mentally, though, you know?
Love it. This is very, very useful info. I'm sorry that we've run out of time because I would have liked to have asked you a whole lot more, but this is very interesting. The spirulina. I love this. And I, you know, it's great to have a refresher on like what spirulina does, because I haven't even heard that term for a long time, which means that I've been out of it for a little while. But it's great to have you refresh us on things like supplements, having a healthy diet, breaking bad habits. These are things we need to keep on top of. Thank you, Vanessa. It's great to see you.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. Vanessa Senshaw, who is with us this morning. And we've got a whole lot more heading for you in the next hour. We've got, among other things, Gilly Apta will be joining us, who's terrific. We love Gilly. She's going to be dropping in for a little bit. Alan Committee is with us and Simpiwe Mtetwa. We've got lots to do. Stick around. CliffCentral.com on a Wednesday morning. CliffCentral.com.